This is Mireya Loza. It is the 12th of January, 2008. I am in Tucson, Arizona, with Ramiro A. Pompa. Ramiro's interview is part of a series of interviews with four Pompa siblings. Ramiro, can you tell me when and where you were born?
Yes, I was born here in the Phoenix metro area, but it was a small community called El Mirage, and actually El Mirage, Arizona, El Miraje. And El Miraje in itself was one of the founding farming communities, and my father was very connected to that community because he knew a lot of the residents there. You know, El Radio Campesina, who's very popular through the National Farm Workers Association, they were kind of getting things started in that community as well. So. My father made a lot of connections there, and one of the unique ones was just a family doctor there. They had no one else to turn to for medical attention, things like that. So myself and my younger brother, Arnulfo, we were both born, believe it or not, in a doctor's office. So basically rushing down there as quickly as my father could get my mother there both times, because he's always out working. He's always busy around his work environment, but that's a interesting story. Just then, Miraje now has turned out is finally starting to bloom into, you know, a nice bigger community than what it was before. So.
And so, what did your parents do for a living?
Actually, my father was always a farmer, ranch hand of some type. They both, as a bracero, you know, that was the way he came to the United States. And The interesting thing about that was he came here on his own, you know, obviously took advantage of those opportunities to try to create a better life for himself. So as far as, you know, my mother was kind of a jack of all trades. She was a teacher's assistant, did a lot of nursing type, you know, she had a lot of nursing skills, home cooking skills, just anything that she could better her skills at, she would, and she'd find employment in those types of anything that her skill set could fit. She would find it. She would do odds and ends around our communities where we lived. You know, people would seek her out for, you know, cook a big meal for a wedding or a quinceañera or, you know, just an anniversary, things like that. I mean, it was just from that to ironing clothes for the executives down at the Wigwam Resort to, you know, work it out in the fields. And so going back to my father's bracero, you know, under that program, obviously, there were so many different jobs that were available to them. And really, it was just them standing at the border in El Paso trying to cross into the United States under the bracero program. And it was really just coming across the border and really getting orders of where he was going and where he was going to be. So this was him on his own doing this. And here's a guy that couldn't read or write. But a great communicator, and just had a lot of influence over a lot of people. And so, you know, different areas where he ended up, you know, he ended up in Wyoming, Colorado, Idaho. And it was interesting because I said farm working earlier is where we knew him the best growing up. But as a bracero, he did some coal mining, I believe. A lot of things on ranches, a lot of things with animals. But it's so funny because when he finally settled into the States, when he finally received his legal residency and green card, he did become a farmer. He started farming the local community fields here, anything from alfalfa to cotton to, you know, whatever was needed, lettuce, you know, onions, things like that. So,
where was he born?
My dad was born, or our father was born in Los Mochis, Mexico. And I believe that's Sonora. We were trying to figure that out earlier, but I believe it's Sonora, Mexico, is the state, but it's Los Mochis. And he still has an extremely, extremely large family there. We stay in touch with him. It's fantastic to see the contrast between my mother's side of the family, who are very conservative, very, you know, very educated. Educated, and they strive to, you know, to educate their kids and things like that. But and they're all from Chihuahua, Mexico. Then you got my dad's side of the family who are all from Los Mochis. So this big gathering there, they're all farmers, they're all growers, they all, you know, are involved in that type of environment. So obviously that's where my dad got a lot of that skill set, and just, you know, it had to be his love, because that's where we ended up doing what we were doing, you know, so.
Did you grow up in the Mirage area?
No, we didn't. As mentioned earlier, you know, growing up, we were, we lived out in a, out in the West Valley, which is now Litchfield Park, Goodyear, Avondale areas. And they were all farming communities. It was Goodyear Farms was created out there because Goodyear Aerospace and Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company actually had a division out here in Goodyear. And so that's how those little cottages out in the city of Goodyear were created. They were created for some of the foremen, some of the middle management folks that worked over at Goodyear Tire and Rubber. And the Wigwam, which is now a five-star, five-diamond resort in the United States and around the world, and the city of Litchfield Park was being developed for all the executives. All the executives from Ohio, where Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company is corporate out of, all of those executives would come here. They wanted a place to stay, a place to live. And so that's the difference between, you know, how they were already creating segregated areas. So it went from the executives at Litchfield Park, Wigwam, to the Goodyear cottages, to the camps, to, you know. So Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company created Goodyear Farms. Goodyear Farms was a large grower of cotton fields out here, and back in those days, cotton was used to make tires. And so that was a big part of the creation of the tire system, and Goodyear Tire and Rubber, Goodyear Aerospace became a aeronautical environment for the, you know, United States military and stuff. So there was a really nice connection that Goodyear brought to the communities. But, you know, there were certainly certain levels of communities that that were very distinct and very different. As I mentioned earlier, they were very segregated. So as a farmer, he farmed cotton, and I mentioned that earlier. We grew up, you know, as very young kids. You know, I'm 46 now, but I'll tell you, I should have retired 10 years ago, because I've been working since I was 4 or 5. And my kids don't believe that story. And every time we drive by a field and there's people out there picking onions or, you know, working the cotton fields and stuff, I mean, I tell them, I pull over and I say, I know exactly what they're doing, you know, and we experienced that. So, so I think you get a little history of how my mother was just a unique person in herself, because a lot of people in the camps that we lived in Camp 53, there were several, Camp 52, 3, 4, 5, and a lot of people seeked out my mother for cooking tips, for cooking meals, for sewing. People would bring over threads of fabrics and things, and, you know, 2 days later, you know, the little girl would be wearing a brand new dress to Sunday school, or, you know, things like that. She was an amazing woman, and very, very bright. Read novels all the time. Her sisters would send her novels from Mexico all the time, and because back then, obviously, the Hispanic impact here, the Latino impact, wasn't quite there yet. Latinos were still an extreme, extreme minority at that time, so things were hard to find. And so she read books, kept herself very, very educated. And then going back to my father, complete opposite. I couldn't read, couldn't write, but was an amazingly hard worker. Very hard worker.
How many siblings did you have?
Six.
Six?
Yeah. We have a seventh, but she passed away at a very young age, I believe 2 to 3 months old. And again, here is in the environment that my father and my mother were after they wed, you know, the environment that they were growing in was very, extremely, extremely poor.
Can you tell me their names from oldest to youngest?
The first, I can't remember her name, but the oldest now, it would be Delia Angelina Pompa, and her last name now is Nunez. Mm-hmm. After that, it would be Eliobardo Jesus Pompa. After that, it would be Humberto Jose Pompa. And after that, it would be Rosa Emma Pompa Avila. Mm-hmm. And then it would be me, Ramiro Antonio Pompa. And then pobrecito Arnulfo, my last little brother, Arnulfo Pompa, who never got a middle name, and we've always questioned that, but my father never could answer that question, so.
And
What was it like growing up in the camps when you guys were there?
Growing up in the camps was actually a great experience. I mean, we were excited just to have an opportunity to attend a very strong, very well publicized school with a great academic program. Litchfield Park has always been known at a young age to have a very strong academic program. So we were very excited and just honored to have the opportunities to attend those schools. But also, around the camps, it was great. I mean, you had the experiences of growing up, but, you know, we were a little rough around the edges. You know, our parents weren't as educated. I mean, we weren't as, etiquette and just little things that that we did around the camps. I mean, we didn't get up every morning and take a shower and do the things that, you know, we do today. I mean, we would just get up, run out the door bare feet, no shoes, and just enjoy the heck out of the day with our friends and going wherever we could around the camps and just exploring and things like that. So those experiences in themselves were fantastic because we did a lot of things like that. There was a lot of freedom out in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of a field where there's camps and houses and little apartments. It was a unique environment because we could just get up, call each other, and it was the funny thing though is if a friend came over to the house, and it's the weirdest thing that we think back to today, is that, you know, you go to the damn door, you ring the doorbell or you knock on someone's door, but for some reason we always went to someone's house and Umberto, I mean, you'd hear someone and you'd go up and answer the door, but that was our way of calling out one of our friends to go play. Just doing that in itself, I mean, experiencing the environment that we were in, the fields, just taking a walk down a canal and enjoying a conversation with a friend or riding a bike together or whatever. But that experience was great. The conditions of our living conditions were a lot tougher. It was an extremely small two-bedroom apartment with one bathroom, a real small kitchen. For some reason, my father was never upgraded. As hard as he worked and as many years as he put into that company, Goodyear Farms, it was amazing that he never got upgraded to a house. There was other houses, little cottage houses that were available, but for some reason he just never, we never moved to that level of housing. But the house was extremely small. If I had to guess today, it was probably about 500 square feet, if not just slightly smaller or slightly bigger. But
where did everybody sleep?
On top of each other, pretty much. It was a two-bedroom. Here's the uniqueness of my parents. They would just provide when they could. You know, for a lot of years, we just slept wherever we could in our room. And eventually, they saved enough money, worked hard enough, and we all did. I mean, and one day they just showed up, and they had bunk beds in the back, two sets of bunk beds, and then a large bed for my sister or my two sisters. And so, I'm sorry, one set of bunk beds. So Elio and I, my oldest brother, Elio Bardo, he and I had the bottom bunk, and Arnulfo and Humberto had the top bunk, and my sister, our two sisters slept on the, next to us in a smaller bed. So that's how we all stacked up in there. And then my parents obviously had the other room, but those living conditions were... they were okay. I mean, and the reason I think they were okay and they were enjoyable is because of the environment that my parents created. I mean, it was Saturday morning. I mean, we were all up mopping floors, cleaning stuff. I mean, everything was spotless in there. My mother just kept an unbelievable house, and it always smelled great. My God, it was either tortillas cooking or, frijoles, always, every day. Girlfriends to this day, or even my wife, just first time she, met my parents, and it was a breakfast meeting with my folks. Any girlfriend or anything, it didn't matter if it was breakfast, lunch, or dinner, or just a snack, but there was always frijoles and tortillas on the table, and it would just flip people out. But once they dug into them, though, they extremely enjoyed them. But so as far as that environment, the housing environment, it was fine. But it was tough. Other families were even more rough around the edges than we were. I mean, we had rules around our house. We were very respectful towards our parents. Other families didn't have that level of control or attitude about, their household. And so we ran across issues with other kids. And, it was your typical rough little neighborhood if it wanted to be. But for the most part, it was so close. We were all so close and so tight that we got to know each other well enough where, you know, we'd have our spouts, but, you know, 2 days later, we're best friends again. So so that part of it was fine. But I'll tell you, going to Litchfield Park Elementary School, and then, you know, having friends in an upper, middle, upper income environment, knowing where I lived, we were treated differently. And I would have to say that, and I got to say this on tape because, you know, I'm obviously very light-skinned, reddish hair. My father was the same way. I looked a little different. I looked white growing up. So I didn't get picked on as bad. But I saw a lot of kids get picked on. You know, if I got picked on for anything, it was because of the clothes I was wearing or shoes that had holes in them or, you know, whatever. You know, that experience at school was a little tough on other kids. So for me, I actually enjoyed it. I had a very, very good experience at Litchfield Elementary School. I you know, I thank them today because I think if it would have been another type of public school, I don't know if our education level would have gotten as high as it did today.
Were there a lot of other Latino students in Litchfield Park when you were there?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was different. I mean, we were, you know, we went through all the, you know, comments from, you know, the kids that were just always made inappropriate comments or racial slurs, as we call them today, you know, dirty Mexicans, things like that. But that's one of the things we never understood why we were called dirty Mexicans, because we were always probably the cleanest kids there. I mean, we were always wearing black pants and white shoes and, yeah, I mean, whatever. But we were always neatly dressed. Shirts were always ironed. Hair was always combed and well kept. And it was just interesting. But the other kids, again, you know, some of the kids were a little, came from even more humble, you know, surroundings and stuff. So some of them experienced things a little differently. But for me individually, I know my brothers and sisters had different experiences. But again, I really enjoyed my experiences at Litchfield Elementary. It was very interesting.
Can you describe a little bit of the layout of the actual camp?
Yes. It's basically you come off a major highway, and back then it was a major highway or road, and that led from, it was probably about 3 miles west of where Litchfield Park is today, the original town, the Wigwam Resort and all that area. We're about 3 miles west of there, three and a half, 4 miles west of there. And basically it was just off Indian School Road, a two-lane road, which is now a huge, you know, major highway here. But it was called Alsop Avenue, and you just head west, turn left on Alsop, and immediately as soon as you turn, it's just a dirt road. Mm-hmm. You turn in, all the apartments set up that I was mentioning earlier. There was apartments on the left, and all the housing was on the right. So as you can see, even in our own camps, there was segregation there as well. And as I mentioned earlier, we never understood why. Here we were a pretty good family and hardworking family, but yet we stayed in the two-bedroom apartment side and never really developed over to the housing or the cottage side. So, and we knew families that were over there were basically, you know, destroying them, and, you know, I mean, we would have, for lack of a better word, we would have died to get in there. But anyway, we were comfortable. Any street that you went in, it was basically a loop, and you turn left onto Alsop, you make an immediate left, and it's just a big horseshoe. And the apartments just started, and they whipped all the way around, and there was apartments down the middle. And so we actually used to call it Pampa Curve and the Frosto Curve and then something Avenue, and it was funny. We used to make all kinds of names up, but our playground was basically that main street that you turned off from the major highway, Alsop. It was just a huge, you know, dirt road like this. And then this is the horseshoe coming back up, but this was our playground. We used to play out there on rocks, on pebbles, on stone, you name it, barefoot. And we'd run through sticker patches, and, I mean, nothing would kill us. Nothing would bother us. But that was our primary playground. And so to the right, you're looking at all the cottages, all the homes, and same thing. It was just a big horseshoe going this way, but now you got little houses that are separated from each other, whereas these are all apartments, and they're just divided up. So,
and what was your relationship with your father like? Would your father ever tell you about his experiences in the U.S. as a bracero, or did he keep it to himself?
At that time, he probably was sharing information, but honestly, as being very young at that time, I mean, and when I mean young, we basically started kindergarten, born here, you know, that kind of thing. So we lived there through probably fourth grade, fifth grade, something like that. And the experiences with my dad were hard work. He expected hard work from us. And any job that he had that he was doing, he would take us out. But here's the beauty of the way my father approached these things. He didn't just take us out because he wanted us to help him or, you know, use us as, you know, child labor, whatever you want to call it. But it was his way of training us, his way of showing us, hey, man, this is how hard I have to work just to do the things that we have. Here's how you use a shovel. Here's how you drive a Chevy with or a Ford with three gears on the column. Here's how you begin an irrigation system. You know, here's how you water this. Here's what we do. Yeah, but it wasn't just the training part, but it was the show me how to use the shovel. You know, give me this, do this. It was just his way of showing us developing a skill set. You know, he was already starting to develop us at a very young age. How to work hard, how to be on time, how to take good care of things, take pride in what you've got. And to this day, I will tell you, I got to stop right there and just share an experience, a life experience now that I know that my brothers and sisters are recognized the same way by their neighbors, their friends, whoever. But I have been told so many times by so many people that they appreciate how much pride I take in anything that I own, whether it's a old truck, a new car, my house, you know, my clothing, whatever. They just appreciate how much I take good care of things and, you know, how much pride we take in the appearance of our houses and, you know, our children and their manners and things like that. So that's part of my dad's training environment as well, just the hard work, the etiquette, the manners, the way we are seen in public. One of the great things that my dad used to tell me all the time is just say, Dad, you know, mijo, no se te olvide. Es más importante tener, you know, los amigos en lugar de enemigos. You know, in other words, you know, have your friends. You know, there's a difference between friends, associates, and just, you know, amistades, you know, whatever. But I guess what I'm getting to is if I had to describe my dad in a political sense, he was an extreme, he was the best diplomatic person I've ever met in my life. And I think that's one of the characteristics that we all have developed as well. I'm involved in a lot of negotiations, a lot of major projects, environment, nonprofit agencies that I deal today, and I still use a lot of these same skills. It's the same old things that he taught me back then about extending a handshake, you know, the right way, and a sus órdenes, Ramiro Pompa a sus órdenes, you know, the old sayings he used to tell us, but... And it's the basic stuff, you know, that people don't use today, and it's real simple. Thank you very much. You're very welcome. It's great meeting you. It's a pleasure to know, you know. But those are things that my dad started at a very young age, whether, again, it's the hard work, the manners, and things like that. It was an amazing process that he put us through. Mm-hmm. So, and we didn't realize that at that time because we fought with him so much, and we gave him so much crap about everything, and I think I was probably the biggest whiner about going out to the field. Ya vámonos, ya son las cinco, vámonos. And I'd be in bed crying, man, going, I don't want to go out there, man, shit. So anyway, but long story short is that it was just his way of preparing us. And back then, obviously, at a young age, you don't recognize it, but to this day, and as you're growing as an adult into adulthood, it's amazing. You look back and you're like, God, now I know why you always told me that. Or now I, oh my God, you know. And it's funny because, like I said, I mentioned the shovel earlier, you know. I have a friend that owns a construction company, and, you know, I lost my job several years ago, and he offered me a job. So, you know, we were out doing a little, we were testing some site and stuff, and he grabbed a shovel, and he was trying to show me how to use a shovel. And that's how ignorant he was to thinking that I didn't know. And I started laughing, so I just kind of pushed him away, grabbed the shovel, and started going to work. And before you knew it, I became his second, you know, his right-hand man. I mean, out of like 30 or 40 people that he had, because he saw how hard I could work. I came to work, I went to work, I didn't screw around, I did my job, did it well, and went home. So
when was the first time in the camps that you actually heard anything at all about the braceros, or your father mentioned that he was a bracero? Do you remember around what age you were?
Yeah, I was probably about 7 or 8, and the reason I remember this distinctly is because it wasn't so much the conversation that he was having with me. It's the conversation that he was having with friends over a break, you know, over a beer and playing cards or a little gathering in the neighborhood. I would hear the stories that he'd be sharing with other people. I mean, he was a very captive person. He always had a captive audience. You know, it would start with one or two people, and before you knew it, I mean, people were kind of inching their way and making their way towards the circle. And I'd just be standing there. I'd probably tagged along, followed him over to wherever he was going, and I'd listen to his stories and hear about his trips to these states that I mentioned earlier: Colorado, Idaho, Utah, no, Wyoming, and obviously Arizona, Texas. Some in California, but mostly those other states that I mentioned earlier. So his stories were great, but it's in the later years where he started sharing more around the Bracero program. But the things that he shared with me, as I'm one of the youngest, was more around, can you help me research the Bracero program? You know, I'm understanding that, you know, I heard on the Radio Campesina that this is going on, and they're interviewing people. They're trying to figure out what's going on around this. So so that's how I got involved with it. We actually received a letter inviting him to go in and apply for – it was more of just a registration process. And the registration process was more just to put him on the list, let people know that, hey, Gildardo Pompa was a bracero. So if anything ever came up with it, it was – all the pay and taxes or whatever it was that they were owed, and there was a big, you know, investigation or research around that, but not just that, but the historical data behind it and the you know, the stories behind the Bracero program. So that part of it I know there, but the other parts were really, really enjoyable stories of him just telling people how much he enjoyed visiting places in Colorado and in Idaho and how beautiful it was. And I mean, he would just really take you there. If you closed your eyes, I mean, you were literally there while he's telling you these stories. And even as, you know, as we were getting older and we'd pay him visits and stuff, I had a very unique relationship with my father. He called me for just about any home improvement or fix-up jobs that he needed around the house. I was always taking care of things here and there. And but at the same time, we developed such a different bond, because as a younger child, I had a more difficult relationship with my father, just a little tougher relationship. I was very stern. I was very I wasn't a pushover. You know, I wouldn't take a lot of his, you know, direction and stuff. But that's, again, one of those traits that I learned from him, you know, to be able to stand up for yourself and protect your interest and, you know, do things the way, you know, have a say, have a word. Don't just sit and be told what to do. Take a leadership role and do things. So, yeah, we had our differences growing up and stuff. But at an older age, I mean, it was just the unique stories. But my relationship with him was around, you know, his home and making a safe home for them as they were aging. But I always stayed close to them. I always, you know, I was always just a few miles away from them. You know, he'd call me, and I can still hear his voice today when he just called me in the middle of 5 o'clock in the morning, go, mijo, ya están los tacos, vente, you know, and I'd go over there, have coffee with him on a regular basis, you know, just sit there and talk for hours and just listen to a lot of these stories around the Bracero program, a lot of his stories and experiences around Goodyear Farms. You know, the camps, families, You know, it was his way of catching up with me around that as well, but it was also his way of telling me, hey, did you know so-and-so's really sick? Did you know so-and-so passed away? Hey, you know, you should go pay these people a visit or, so.
You were born towards the end of the Racero program, weren't you?
Yeah. Yeah.
What year were you?
Yeah, 61.
61.
Yeah.
And so you were very, very, very little.
Yeah.
The braceros were just
when it,
leaving.
Yeah, when it was peaking, when it was peaking, I think it was probably, well, Elia was right at the beginning, Elio, and then Humberto, I would say, it was probably right around when it was peaking, and Rosa was towards the end of it, and obviously, you know, myself and our younger brother, Arnulfo.
You got the last couple of years.
Yeah.
And,
but by that time, he had already separated himself from the Bracero program completely. So he had already received he had a green card, you know, residency, him and my mom. He was making his regular trips up here as a Bracero, taking the jobs. And it was probably early 50s when he went back, if not late 40s. He went back, married my mother, and eventually brought her here. You know, but it's amazing that you hear all the things that are going on today. And here's a great example of my father always following the rules and doing things the right way. Do it right the first time. That was one of the best things he always told me. Don't waste your time with that. And even though he did things a little awkward himself. But you know, he waited many, many years to get his paperwork together. I mean, he stood in many lines and, no money in his pocket. Just struggling to try to get everything in order to make sure that he could cross the border appropriately and begin a new life, so.
And because you caught the Bracero program at the tail end, do you recall when you were really, really tiny meeting Braceros who had come back to this area as undocumented workers and had been part of the Bracero program?
There were. We were already probably in our teens, though, and I would say that there was probably, God, if I remember right, probably two or three that my father knew of. Mm-hmm. And just from them really immigrating from one state to another. And they were doing odd jobs, you know, at that time as well. I mean, you know, working in the fields with us or, you know, getting a job as an actual farmer, you know, in irrigation and all that with Goodyear Farms and stuff. But I don't remember a lot of details around them, so.
And when you stated that you were picking cotton at a very tiny age.
We were. I still, it's amazing that I can vividly and very clearly, very clearly remember, you know, being dragged on those sacks and, you know, they're basically between your legs and you got the harness and they're picking cotton and throwing it in this big long sack and, you know, my little brother and I, Arnulfo and I are just being dragged along. I mean, that was the babysitting. That was the daycare center out there. I mean, we never, those didn't exist. So everywhere they went, we went. And so as we got older, I mean, we got involved. We wouldn't stand around and just watch. I mean, we'd get involved in the work and help and, you know, help earn a wage as well. So
at 3 years old, when you were really little, I know it's hard to remember. Do you remember there being a lot more men in the field than women?
I don't remember at that age, but I do remember though that it was a good mix. I mean, there were a lot of women out there too. My mother was a hard worker. I mean, it was amazing that she had all those skills. And here's the tough thing that just one of the things that really we ponder this a lot. You know, as bright as the individuals that both of our parents were. We just wonder with a little education, a little bit more resources that are available today to so many Hispanics and so many, even illegal or legal, there's so many resources that are available out there. And we ponder this, you know, if those resources were available to, you know, our mother and father at that time, we wonder how far further we would have climbed and really, you know, been more successful at a younger age or whatever. But, and we don't regret anything, but we ponder that because he was a very bright man. He was very sharp. He could negotiate like no one's business. I mean, he could sell you a dead horse, and he was an amazing guy. He just had a way of presenting things to people, and he's a good salesperson. So. Mm-hmm.
And as a really, I guess, tiny child, do you ever recall any of these older men talking to you or getting closer to you? Because many of them didn't have their own children.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you were one of a handful of children, I assume.
Yeah. It was rare. For us, it was rare. But it was scary, too, because we were young and we were so forgiving, and we were also so trusting and to anyone and everyone back then. I mean, we were basically loose. I mean, mm-hmm. we didn't lock doors. We didn't do any of that stuff. I mean, not like you do today. I mean, we'd literally, as I mentioned earlier, friend would show up, we'd go walking 4 or 5 miles down the fields and just go wherever and bump into, working men, working women out there, and just do whatever, and felt free and very trustworthy. But every once in a while, yeah, someone would talk to us or mention things about, our father or our mother and things like that. But
And do you recall in your childhood going to social events or things that went on in the camps
mm-hmm.
that everyone participated in? What do children do to socialize in the camps? What do families do?
Because it was close. It was a, we had our, it's no different than it is today. You live next to your neighbors, you get to know them. Well, maybe it is a little different because I don't know my neighbors very well, but at a young age, we knew all of our neighbors. We knew everyone in the camps. We knew what house, where everyone was at. And so there was some connection to some families more than others. I think you mentioned earlier about, interviewing our eldest brother, Elio, and his stories about the Frosto family, who had just the most unique names in the world. I mean, we were very close to that family. We were close to the Enriquez family. We were close to the Parras, to the Lopez, a couple of other families in the community. But so when there was a birthday party, absolutely. We're a part of the whole thing. But it was amazing that you show up to these parties, and it was funny because all the boys would have white shirts and black pants, and we'd all be dressed up in shoes, and and here we're walking down, a dirt road to get to these things and these events, and or it was a dance. I mean, they'd have a wild party somewhere, and they were always so festive and so it was always just so much enthusiasm around it. It's just a lot of fun. I remember that very clearly. I mean, we always had a really good time. I remember they called him El Indio, but his name was Esteban Gaspar, and he lived across from us. His wife Esperanza. Well, Esteban, and my father, and several other men in the community in the camp wanted to have a cookout. So they dug this huge hole, and Esteban had lamb, and my father had a roast and things like that. I mean, it was really, really neat. That I remember that experience really neat, because that really brought the whole community. I think that was the event that I remember the most that brought everyone together for this thing. Everyone was excited, couldn't wait to taste the food. I mean, and they were drinking. You could hear the music, and all the kids were playing. I mean, running around doing whatever. It was that. I remember that being a lot of fun. So. But I also remember Saturday catechism classes with this little St. John Vianney bus that would drive around and pick us all up and stuff. And, so.
And do you, recall your siblings ever saying anything about workers or working around these men?
Yeah.
Or where they lived?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing was, I mentioned the status and even the camp community, how you have the apartments and you have this and you have that. I mean, there was some folks, if I remember correctly, I mean, they didn't have a place to live. They were homeless. They'd live wherever they could, that's one of the other things that my parents were very... They're very open. They helped a lot of people in the community. Mm-hmm. They always opened their homes to friends and people in need. And as I mentioned earlier, my mother had, some amazing nursing skills. I mean, she could mend any wound, but maybe that's just any mother. But that's the way I remember my mother, being very extraordinary around those skills. But she mended a lot of people. She helped a lot of people in the community. I mean, that's what made my father so unique. And I think you mentioned that earlier about other people that mentioned my father. You know, he had an extraordinary life and things, but they were always very welcome to everyone. Very friendly with people and just very well connected with everyone. So.
Well, let's get to kind of the more contemporary moments. After you graduated from Litchfield Park, where did you go on to?
Well, we didn't graduate from there because, believe it or not, my parents actually, the whole community was approached on new housing that was taking place, and it was an organization called Farmers Home, and basically it was housing for low-income individuals, and my parents qualified for it. So we actually moved from Litchfield to this new housing development that is now part of Avondale. They used to call it Las Ligas, and it was Cashin, Las Ligas, and now it's just Avondale, because Avondale annexed that whole area. But we moved there when I was right around in the fifth grade. And so we moved from the Litchfield elementary schools. And the ones that were affected by that were really Rosa, Arnulfo, and myself. So Elio and Burton, they were pretty much settled in at Owl Free already at the high school that they were at. So they remained there. So we made that transition over to the Cashin Elementary, Underdown Junior High, you know, schools over here. And so we actually ended up graduating from Underdown Junior High School in Cashin, Arizona. And the interesting thing about that is that we went from one community to another community and then started attending school in the Cashin community, who was also a very strong Hispanic community. A lot of farmers, but so funny because they seemed to be a little more ahead in the game. You know, they had the landscape jobs, they had the mechanic jobs, they had the you know, they worked at more prominent places instead of, you know, still being stuck in the fields, working in the fields and things like that. So I graduated from there, and we're actually sitting in Tolleson High School, where myself and Rosa went to high school. So I think I was telling my brother the other room we were in, I think I took literature in that class. But anyway, Rosa and I went here. The rest of the siblings went to Owl Free High School over in Avondale. So,
how much older are Estelia and Elio and Humberto from you?
Well, the funny thing is that I can't give you an exact. Well, we could figure it out, but just a guesstimate. I mean, it was funny because I think Humberto, our brother, always says it best, man. You know, when mom and dad wanted to have kids, man, they just had kids. So they did it, knocked it all out in one shot. So so basically what I mean by that is that we're all basically within a year, year and a half apart. So we're all right there. I mean, you go 53, 55, you know, 40, 42, 44, 46, 46, you know what I'm saying? We're all right after one another, so. And it was amazing that they just, like, called it quits after six, man, so. But we're all very close in age, and I think that obviously has been a bonding force for us, being close enough in age to be able to enjoy each other's company, you know, and experience things together, and certainly, I think the biggest thing with our family is not so much that we relied on each other, but we depended on each other. And the responsiveness from my brothers and sisters has been absolutely tremendous. Anything that this family needs, or any need that anyone in this family had at a young age, middle age, whatever, and even today, you know, our family is very unique in the fact that they drop what they're doing and they make themselves available. Mm-hmm. So.
And so after high school, what did you go on to do?
After high school, while going to school here, I actually ran the aquatics program here for Tolleson High School. I, you know, became a lifeguard and started managing the programs here for them. And from here I started, I was during the summers. And then after the summers were over, I'd go back to school. And I actually started school at a junior college at Glendale Community College. So I was interested in trying to play basketball somewhere, because I played basketball here at Tolleson High School, and I had a successful career here with that. And I was trying to continue to pursue that. And, you know, my coaches were trying to get me connected to folks. So I was driving all the way out to Scottsdale Community College when it popped up, and it was very, very new. There were no highways, no freeways or anything, so I was literally taking side streets from here all the way to Scottsdale, which was extremely far at the time. And so I'd play in summer league pickup games. You know, the coaches there would, you know, basically rate me and things like that, and I just bounced around doing things like that. So that's what led me to junior college, because, or a, you know, smaller community college, because I was trying to still accomplish that goal. I really wanted to continue to try to play basketball somewhere. So I ended up there, and then I ended up in a mortgage banker's program when I got into banking. Actually, the board president here at Tolleson High School, who has continued to be a tremendous friend and a tremendous mentor as I was growing up, John Cardinetto, and I'll be very happy to mention his name. He was actually a board president. He approached me the last year, my senior year. I'm sorry, I was a freshman in college already. He approached me. He brought his daughters in and asked me if I would teach him how to swim, and I said absolutely. Plugged him into the program, and I had a great time with that, great experience with his kids. They were so afraid of the water and stuff, but he just approached me. After they went through the program the whole summer, he approached me and asked me, you know, what do you do after this? And I said, I just go back to school. And he goes, what do you do for work? And I said, I just get odd jobs here and there. And he said, I'll tell you what. He goes, there's a Saturday teller position at my office, and he goes, and I'd love for you to consider it. And so I did. I applied, and it's so funny, you know, you always hear the comment, it's not what you know, it's who you know. And that was amazing, because it was obvious to me that I had the job. I mean, he was going through formalities interviewing me and stuff, and when I walked out, he gave me a very, very clear direction or impression that I was more than likely going to be hired, and I was. And so here I started as a Saturday teller, working from 9 to 2, Saturdays only, making, I don't know, $4 or $5 an hour, right? So from there, I got into the banking environment. I became a personal banker. I was a great salesman, you know, as a teller, and they moved me over here. And before you knew it, I became a loan officer. And I started educating myself around the financial environment. So I had to obviously improve my skills to continue to you know, climb the ladder, as they say. But under the Mortgage Bankers Association, basically I earned a degree through the Mortgage Bankers Association for lending. And, you know, obviously they have a set curriculum of, you know, financial analysis, things like that. So, and then from there, odd, you know, classes here and there that I needed to pick up at different colleges and stuff. I took, you know, emergency medical technician classes. You know, I was pursuing, ELEO was a big, ELEO is a tremendous individual, and I really followed him. I tried to follow his footsteps into the fire science, firefighter environment and stuff, and I was actually a volunteer at one of the Avondale fire departments, and he got me involved in that as well, and I really enjoyed it. I really loved the experience, but it's a difficult environment to get into, but I tried to pursue that with him. So, you know, I also took a lot of, as I mentioned, the emergency medical technician classes, a lot of anatomy and stuff like that. So, because if the basketball thing wasn't working out, I had a real interest in the nursing medical environment and stuff. But here I ended up in banking, and all because of a friend and someone that knew me here at the school and enjoyed watching me play basketball. His wife would always come up to me and say, man, I wish I could go back in time and go back and watch that team you guys had and stuff, because we really enjoyed it. But all because of that one contact and the way he connected me into the bank, here I am today. I mean, I've been in banking almost 26 years, and it has been a fabulous ride, and just it's been extremely rewarding to me and my family, and obviously to other members of my family as well. So,
nearing the end of the interview, but I usually have a couple of questions about the Bracero program. How do you feel that the Bracero program affected your family?
It had a tremendous effect on our family. Obviously, without the Bracero program, we probably would not be here today. And it could have been a life-changing experience. I mean, even to the point where my parents wouldn't have taken the actions that they took. You know, maybe their family plans would have been different. You know, maybe they would have only had 2 children in Mexico instead of 6. A lot of things around that, but also around just the fact that he took major risks to improve his environment, to improve his life, improve his family environment, and certainly his lifestyle. But the Bracero program was extremely important to our family because it provided those resources to him. It allowed him that opportunity to come across the border, enter a completely different environment, and take advantage of the program, take advantage of the opportunities that they were putting in front of him, experiencing the things that he just loved talking about, experiencing, you know, being in different states, being in the United States, being in different environments, different types of jobs, really getting a feel for, hey, you know what, where do I want to end up, what do I want to do? And so that in itself, he obviously came here. Most people, I think, came here and stayed here, but there were those few that came here just to work and returned. They wanted to go back to their home country, but here's the man that couldn't read, couldn't write, took the risk, moved his whole, I mean, he devastated. My mother's family was devastated when they left. A few of them wanted to come with him, but they were so frightened, they were so scared to take the risk. But my dad was like, hey, you do it or you don't do it. It's a leap of faith, but I'm doing it. And he did it. And with that said, I mean, and the things that he showed us around the skill sets that he learned around the Bracero program, the things that he learned around those different job opportunities he had, you know, he shared a lot of that stuff with us. He just shared all of that. My mother being here, and then obviously the resources that became available to us as children, you know, being able to attend Litchfield Elementary School, being able to attend school, period. We didn't know how to speak very good English. I mean, you know, and here we are today. I mean, people are amazed that I'm even Hispanic. They don't believe it, and they don't believe the background, the history that I have. You know, there's no accent, there's no this, there's no that, and the way we present ourselves, I mean, they just do not believe a word, and that's why our kids today don't believe any of it. So this is so important for us to document this information and really provide a history, because our children need to know about it as well, because they need to understand the values that we grew up with, and specifically the core values, the hard work, the, you know, the great intentions around friends and family, and just responsiveness to the needs of other people, and you know, community work that I have continued to do in the community. Obviously, you know, Delia and Rosa have been very involved in things as well. I'm not sure as far as Bert and Arnulfo, but, you know, Elio, obviously, I mean, with his background in public service, you know, I have been extremely involved. Part of my job in banking, I had a position with Bank of America as in community development and economic development. And that was probably the most unique experience I've ever had in my life, because that in itself gave me the opportunity to get connected to organizations like Chicanos por la Casa, La Raza, National Council of La Raza, so many others, National Farm Workers. I mean, I helped finance some of the, you know, put together some of the programs and some of the financing packages for their new apartment complex and their housing division down in Yuma. We did the one in El Miraje. We did some work with Radio Campesina doing a radio telethon to inform people about predatory lending, talk to them about mortgage opportunities, you know, the fact that there's down payment assistance programs that we've created for them, and all these types of assistance and stuff. But that has been the most unique experience, because my parents grew up going, I remember going into Valley National Bank in Litchfield Park with my dad, and he was trying to apply for a loan. And basically, their answer was already no as soon as we walked in. But remembering those experiences that they had, having a difficult time applying for just to buy furniture, just to buy a car, just to open up an account, just to cash a check, the way they were treated, the way today it's called redlining, you know, not allowing or providing the services to low-income individuals. You know, the bank's always pursuing the elite or the higher-end customers. And so that type of redlining existed extremely, extremely well back then. And today, I mean, people get in trouble for that. Banks get shut down because they redline and don't make services available to everyone. That experience that I had in community development was very unique in the fact that I remembered all those things. And so when I get in front of individuals or we do a major presentation for nonprofit agencies or even to the constituents themselves, you know, the individuals that are seeking assistance, you know, it's amazing the reaction that some of the people get, because the way I present things to them, I think they, I don't have to say it, I think they know that I probably experienced similar, I was probably in their shoes at one point, you know, from my parents' standpoint. So we have put so many people in houses, and it is amazing the reaction that they get. I've been invited to so many carne asadas on Sundays, man. Ramiro, tienes que venir. Yeah, I mean, just all these letters and thank you cards, and it's an amazing and very, very satisfying environment that I was in. So, and now I'm actually on the lending side again, and so really touching a lot of lives again, helping a lot of people get into homes, showing them how to get things financed, showing them how to get accounts open, really providing that education to create what my father taught us a long time ago without the resources. Now these people have the resources to create stability, a great environment, generation from generation, they're going to have a home, they're going to have housing, they're going to have all the necessary things to create a great stable environment and life for their families, you know, for years to come. So
thank you very much.
Oh, you're very welcome.
That's part of your father's legacy.